Luke 5, verses 1 through 11. And it came to pass, as the people pressed upon him to hear the word of God, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret and saw two ships standing by the lake. But the fishermen were gone out of them and were washing their nets. And he entered into one of the ships, which was Simon's, and prayed him that he would thrust out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the people out of the ship. Now when he had left speaking, he said unto Simon, Launch out into the deep, and let your nets for a draught. And Simon answering said unto him, Master, we have toiled all the night, and have taken nothing. Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net. And when they had done this, they enclosed a great multitude of fishes, and their net brake. And they beckoned unto their partners, which were in the other ship, that they should come and help them. And they came and filled both the ships, so that they began to sink. And when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord. For he was astonished, and all that were with him, at the draught of the fishes which they had taken. And so was also James and John, the sons of Zebedee, which were partners with Simon. And Jesus said unto Simon, Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men. And when they had brought their ships to land, they forsook all and followed him.
So our topic today is the section about when the catch of the fish and the net broke. And as Justin read for us in Luke chapter 5, fishing was an important part of the Galilean economy, as reflected in place names like Bethsaida, House of Fish, or Tarichaea, or Magdala. And that one would be Preserved Fish Town. Just doing the research for this part, you learn a lot more about fishing other than what we might think about, like, you know, a hut fin, throwing a line in or something like that. So the major types of fish in the Sea of Galilee would have been tilapia, carp, and sardines. And much of the catch would have been dried for sale or manufactured into fish sauce and imported throughout the Mediterranean world. It was embedded in the larger Roman economy of the Roman Empire, and that's a whole different topic right there. There was a lot involved in that from what they were doing in the fishing. In 1986, a fishing boat from the time of Jesus was discovered on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee, largely made of cedar and oak. Too bad we didn't have any demonstration here, but the boat measured 26.5 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, and 4.5 feet deep. It could hold approximately 1 ton, either 5 crew members and the catch, or the crew and 10 passengers, and again, according to how much things weighed and all that. They could have used a large dragnet, which may have been hundreds of feet long, or a circular casting net approximately 6.3 to 8.8 yards in diameter. And they may also have used a hook and a line. And after each period of fishing, the nets were washed, stretched, and prepared for reuse. Galilean fishermen were most often employees or partners in small family-run businesses or cooperatives. Storms were a real danger in that they could come in quickly off the Mediterranean through the wind tunnel formed by the Arbel Pass. And I know I had mentioned once before when I was, the ship I was on when we were in the Med, we were in port, tied up, and this storm came from nowhere, and it was vicious. We actually had to let the lines go and head out because it was so, we would have been ripped apart. That's how fast these storms come up in the calm Mediterranean. This is just a little background before we get into the part of it. Numerous scenes in the Gospels took place on or near the Sea of Galilee. Actually, the sea was about 64 square miles, and fishing was extremely profitable on the lake. In some fishing business, there were In this business, it was different than most modern Bible students imagine. Individuals just didn't go out fishing and then bring the catch to some processor. This was controlled by Herod Antipas. He controlled the sea, the harbors, the fishing rights, bridges over which the catch could be caught. They sold these rights to brokers and New Testament tax collectors or publicans who contracted with the fishermen. You had Matthew, or Levi, evidently was one of those. And Zebedee was a fisher with two working sons, James and John, and hired laborers. Fishing families sometimes formed collectives or cooperatives, as we mentioned, to bid for fishing contracts or leases. So this is really pretty intense. You don't even think about all this. Peter, Andrew, James, and John, with their fathers, seem to have formed such a cooperative. And that's in Matthew 4 and then Luke 5 and 10. The common mode of fishing appears to have been with nets made of flax. The fishermen made them, mended, washed, and dried them. The casting net was cast from a boat or along the shoreline, and the larger dragnet was also cast from a boat. So at least four and possibly more of the Lord's disciples were fishermen, as we just read. They knew the changeable moods of the Sea of Galilee and were skilled in determining where fish might be caught. Jesus used this knowledge and experience to teach them important aspects of the gospel and about discipleship. As he said in Matthew 4:19, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." The appropriateness of the figure was shown a short time later when, during the important explanation of his teaching in parables concerning the coming kingdom, in Matthew 13, Jesus likened the kingdom to a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind, which, when it was full, they drew to shore and sat down and gathered the good into vessels and cast the bad away. How the disciples would have appreciated the force of this word picture. And again, we always see throughout his ministry that this really helped to explain things to people that they were familiar with. The whole process of fishing in its every part had a new meaning now. It was applied to the redemptive purpose of Yahweh. The cooperation needed between fishermen for their task to be successful must exist also between those who together preach the word, as a fishing net must be intact if it is to catch fish, obviously. So the community of believers should be soundly based and free from schism if it is to preach effectively. The gospel net, like the fisherman's net, draws in a varied catch, the sorting of which must take place at a future time. These and other teachings drawn from the parallel between the disciple and a fisherman can be found in the New Testament writings, but additionally, on two separate occasions, actual fishing incidents were so affected by the Lord's presence that the parable was given greater urgency and deeper meaning. The specific call of Peter, James, and John followed an occasion when Jesus had commandeered one of their fishing boats for use as a preaching tool. The listening crowd were ranged in front of him on the gently shelving shore while he utilized the additional height of the boat and the acoustic properties of the still waters to ensure his message, that it would be heard by a greater number of people. His transference from shore to ship also had the advantage of distancing him from the people who, in Luke 5 and 1 said, pressed upon him to hear the word of God. So there was always crowds around him. Possibly a further hint of something that can be detected on other occasions, that the people's urgency to experience the physical benefits of his powers was sometimes a hindrance and occasionally a threat to the completion of his mission. When he had completed his teaching, Jesus told Peter to take the boat out onto the lake. Now, Peter was too experienced a fisherman and too knowledgeable about the Sea of Galilee to expect much success from a fishing expedition setting out while the sun was high and the water was still. And here's another fact which I think most people might know, but with his companions, Peter had spent the previous night fruitlessly, as it happens, in search of a profitable catch. Now these fishermen, that was the most important time, was at night to go fishing. So to go out there during the day and try to catch fish, that just didn't seem right to them anyway. They were at the shore washing nets that had caught absolutely nothing. And you think about that when we're talking about the preaching and having the nets that don't have holes in them, right? And checking them over to see if any repairs were needed. The last thing he wanted to do was set out again on a worthless mission, and his reply reveals his opinion of anyone foolhardy enough to think it would be worth trying again for the elusive catch. As he said in verse 5, "Master, we have toiled all the night and have taken nothing." And it's important to notice that Peter did not omit the title Master when he addressed Jesus. Whatever he may have thought about his suggestion, the word conveys the two conflicting emotions battling in Peter's mind. When he first heard of Jesus, his brother Andrew described him as the Messiah, the Christ. Peter never, in his most dejected moments, let his reverence for the Son of God, the living God, or never lost it. He was always his Lord. But the word Master also expresses something else. It means teacher. And Peter, somewhat gently but firmly, was saying, "We are fishermen, Lord. You are a teacher. You cannot be expected to know when or where it is good to fish. Leave that to us." This is what he was thinking, in essence. But the one who spoke to Peter was the one who had spoken to the multitudes with authority. And so, in spite of his superior knowledge, as he would think, Peter deferred to Jesus' word in verse 5, "Nevertheless, at thy word, I will let down the net." And imagine his surprise and his embarrassment when his prediction was so roundly countered by the biggest catch he had ever witnessed. In his excitement, his mind was wholly centered on the difficult task of ensuring that none of his sudden change of fortune should slip through his fingers. Now, he was still basically a fisherman, and this is a big catch. The fishermen worked in a frenzy, calling to their partners in the second ship or boat for urgent assistance. And as the net enclosed the catch, straining and even starting to break under the enormous and very active load, each boat began to take on board as many fish as possible. And soon, all the space was taken up as the loaded boat started to sink into the water. And now a problem had to be faced. So long as the sea stayed calm, they might make it safely to shore. But if a storm blew up, and on Galilee they often did, they would have no means of coping with it. This combination of circumstances, the unique and magnificent catch, the bulging and breaking nets, and the imminent danger of sinking brought Peter to his senses. Jesus was not just a master teacher. He had skills in Peter's own special sphere that were beyond his wildest dreams. They were from Yahweh, for the psalmist wrote, "Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of his hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas." That's in Psalm 8. This does not, however, fully explain Peter's reaction. He could have said on turning to Jesus, "You are right, Lord. My judgment was completely wrong. Never again will I doubt your word." But he went beyond this in his response. And this is confirmed also by the attitude he adopted in verse 8. He fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." His behavior suggests that the incident revealed to Peter not only his limited knowledge in areas where he had considered himself to be expert, but how his life had previously been wholly misdirected and how he had been self-centered, not God-centered. How could such a sinful man associate with the Lord, whose sinlessness is implicitly acknowledged by Peter's words? As fishing was his livelihood, Peter would immediately know the likely value of the miraculous catch. Possibly his thoughts had concentrated on this aspect until the point where he was in danger of losing it all, and his boat, and possibly his life as well. and the truth of the situation struck home. So the record adds, explaining his sudden change of mind in verse 9. He was astonished, and all that were with him, at the draught of the fishes which they had taken. So the miracle had therefore prepared the disciples for Jesus to repeat his call to discipleship. The first priority for all disciples is an awareness of the plight of humanity, of each individual's sin and need for forgiveness and redemption. The need also for a changed way of life, walking in God's ways, not our own. And in verse 10, Jesus said to Simon, "Fear not, from henceforth thou shalt catch men." "Don't worry, Peter, I am not leaving you. There's no need to fear that. We can work together on a larger task, fishing for men. Previously you've been catching fish which die. Now you'll be calling men and women so that they can live." With these words from Jesus, all thought of the catch was driven from the minds of Peter and his companions. They had now been caught in Jesus' net. The boats drew to shore, presumably still perilously low down in the water due to the weight of the fish they were carrying. And they were apparently abandoned by the disciples. As it says, when they had brought their ships to land, they forsook all and followed him. In verse 11. There are other crewmen in the boats who did not become Jesus' disciples, and they would have dealt with the fish. But the implication is that Peter, James, and John left without a backward glance. They forsook all, as opposed to Lot's wife. But this is a further miracle where it is necessary to ask for those who benefit it was undertaken. There are no indications that there was desperate hunger in the area or among the families of the fishermen that needed quick relief. So the miracle did not immediately deal with the problem of acute personal suffering. No immediate benefit accrued to Jesus, nor as they were willing to leave the fish behind, to the disciples either. The purpose of the miracle was surely to bring to the disciples' attention in a way only they would fully understand the manner of man who was calling them and what that call would entail. Aspects of the incident hint at teachings they would have to learn again, later. For example, the near sinking of the ship, their peril and need for reliance on this presence of Jesus with them. And it was intensified on another occasion when Jesus was in a boat with them on the Sea of Galilee, and that was the incident in Mark 4. There's one possible benefit from the miracle worth further consideration. Peter, if not others among his companions, was married. Perhaps he had family too, and what was to happen to them while he was away with the Lord? And Jesus said on another occasion, "There is no man that hath left house or wife or children for my sake and the gospel's, but he shall receive an hundredfold now in this time and in the world to come eternal life." That's in Mark 10. Perhaps the takings from the miraculous catch would be some recompense for the removal for a time of the family's breadwinners. Disciples are never asked to forsake existing responsibilities when they commence service for the Lord, as John the Baptist made clear to those who came to him to be baptized, in Luke 3. Jesus' ministry provided special circumstances, and therefore special provision was made in this case. Mark significantly notes they left their father Zebedee in the ship with the hired servants and went after him. It's in Mark 1 and 20. The fishermen had left all, but they were in the company of Jesus, under whose feet Yahweh had put all things. No, their families won't starve. From later hints as well, it can be assumed that the fishing business continued despite the absence of Peter, Andrew, James, and John. A boat was placed at Jesus' disposal whenever he was in the area, and it is always referred to as the ship, as in Mark 6 and 45. And after Jesus' resurrection, Peter encouraged a small group of the disciples to join him in his old trade with the boat and net in John 21. That leads on to what Brother Chris is going to cover probably a year from now. It marked the end of one period of the discipleship and the beginning of another. So as they experienced another unexpected miracle right at the end of Jesus' ministry, and after his resurrection, attention is drawn to the fact that their first miraculous catch occurred right at the beginning. Jesus' ministry involved catching men, but the task was not completed when Jesus died and rose from the dead, for their part in the work was the only just beginning. They needed reminding of their obligations and to be encouraged to see the potential results of their faithful work, for it would have to be undertaken without the physical presence and assistance of the Lord. So on the first occasion, Jesus was with them in the boat, and on the second, he was on the land, not very far away. The implications for disciples who are working almost 2,000 years away from the days when Jesus physically spearheading the campaign are, of course, very strong. Other links between the two miracles and full consideration of the later miracle will be dealt later on. Again, when Chris covers his part. The important truth taught by both miracles is that Jesus is calling men and women. The waters of the nations are being trawled so that the men and women can be caught alive. The very forceful meaning of the Greek word used by the gospel writers is highly relevant and caught for life.